Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of the Confessions of St. Augustine, Volume 9, Book 10, 1. Let me know, for you are the God who knows me. Let me recognize you as you have recognized me. You are the power of my soul. Come into it and make it fit for yourself, so that you may have it and hold it without stain or wrinkle. This is my hope. This is why I speak as I do. This is the hope that brings me joy, when my joy is in what is to save me. As for other things in life, the more we weep for them, the less they merit our tears, and the fewer tears we shed for them, the more we ought to weep for them. We know that you are a lover of faithfulness, for the man whose life is true comes to the light. I wish to act in truth, making my confession both in my heart before you and in this book before the many who will read it. 2. O Lord, the depths of man's conscience lie bare before your eyes. Could anything of mine remain hidden from you, even if I refuse to confess it? I should only be shielding my eyes from seeing you, not hiding myself from you. But now that I have the evidence of my own misery to prove to me how displeasing I am to myself, you are my light and my joy. It is you whom I love and desire, so that I am ashamed of myself and cast myself aside and choose you instead, and I please neither you nor myself except in you. So, O Lord, all that I am is laid bare before you. I have declared how it profits me to confess to you, and I make my confession not in words and sounds made by the tongue alone, but with the voice of my soul and in my thoughts that cry aloud to you. Your ear can hear them, for when I am sinful, if I am displeased with myself, this is a confession that I make to you. And when I am good, if I do not claim the merit for myself, this too is a confession. For you, O Lord, give your benediction to the just, but you make a just man of the sinner. And so my confession is made both silently in your sight, my God, and aloud as well, because even though my tongue utters no sound, my heart cries out to you. For whatever good I may speak to men, you have heard it before in my heart, and whatever good you hear in my heart, you have first spoken to me yourself. 3. Why then does it matter to me whether men should hear what I have to confess, as though it were they who were to cure all the evil that is in me? They are an inquisitive race, always anxious to pry into other men's lives, but never ready to correct their own. Why do they wish to hear from me what sort of man I am, though they will not listen to you when you tell them what they are? When they hear me speak about myself, how do they know whether I am telling the truth, since no one knows a man's thoughts, except the man's own spirit that is within him? But if they listen to what you tell them about themselves, they cannot say the Lord is lying, for to heed what you tell them about themselves is simply to recognize themselves for what they are. And if a man recognizes his true self, can he possibly say, "This is false," unless he himself is a liar? But charity believes all things, that is, which are spoken by those who are joined as one in charity. And for this reason I too, O Lord, make my confession aloud in the hearing of men. For although I cannot prove to them that my confessions are true, at least I shall be believed by those whose ears are open to me by charity. Physician of my soul, make me see clearly how it profits me to do this. You have forgiven my past sins and drawn a veil over them, and in this way you have given me happiness in yourself, changing my life by faith in your sacrament. But when others read of those past sins of mine, or hear about them, their hearts are stirred so that they no longer lie listless in despair, crying, "I cannot." Instead, their hearts are roused by the love of your mercy and the joy of your grace, by which each of us, weak though he may be, is made strong, since by it he is made conscious of his own weakness. And the good are glad to hear of the past sins of others who are now free of them. They are glad not because those sins are evil, but because what was evil is now evil no more. What does it profit me then, O Lord, to whom my conscience confesses daily, confident more in the hope of your mercy than in its own innocence? What does it profit me, I ask, also to make known to men in your sight through this book, not what I once was, but what I now am? I know what profit I gained by confessing my past, and this I have declared. But many people who know me, and others who do not know me, but have heard of me or read my books, wish to hear what I am now, at this moment, as I set down my confessions. They cannot lay their ears to my heart, and yet it is in my heart that I am whatever I am. So they wish to listen as I confess what I am in my heart, into which they cannot pry by eye or ear or mind. They wish to hear, and they are ready to believe. But can they really know me? Charity, which makes them good, tells them that I do not lie about myself when I confess what I am, and it is this charity in them that believes me. 4. But what good do they hope will be done if they listen to what I say? Is it that they wish to join me in thanking you when they hear how close I have come to you by your grace, and to pray for me when they hear how far I am set apart from you by the burden of my sins? If this is what they wish, I shall tell them what I am. For no small good is gained, O Lord my God, if many offer you thanks for me and many pray to you for me. Let all who are truly my brothers love in me what they know from your teaching, to be worthy of their love. And let them sorrow to find in me what they know from your teaching to be occasion for remorse. This is what I wish my true brothers to feel in their hearts. I do not speak of strangers or of alien foes who make treacherous promises and lift their hands in perjury. But my true brothers are those who rejoice for me in their hearts when they find good in me, and grieve for me when they find sin. They are my true brothers, because whether they see good in me or evil, they love me still. To such as these I shall reveal what I am. Let them breathe a sigh of joy for what is good in me, and a sigh of grief for what is bad. The good I do is done by you in me, and by your grace the evil is my fault. It is the punishment you send me. Let my brothers draw their breath in joy for the one, and sigh with grief for the other. Let hymns of thanksgiving and cries of sorrow rise together from their hearts, as though they were vessels burning with incense before you. And I pray you, O Lord, to be pleased with the incense that rises in your holy temple, and for your name's sake to have mercy on me, as you are ever rich in mercy. Do not relinquish what you have begun, but make perfect what is still imperfect in me. So if I go on to confess not what I was, but what I am, the good that comes of it is this. There is joy in my heart when I confess to you, yet there is fear as well. There is sorrow and yet hope. But I confess not only to you, but also to the believers among men. All who share my joy and all who, like me, are doomed to die, all who are my fellows in your kingdom, and all who accompany me on this pilgrimage, whether they have gone before or are still to come, or with me as I make my way through life. They are your servants and my brothers. You have chosen them to be your sons. You have named them as the masters whom I am to serve if I wish to live with you and in your grace. This is your bidding, but it would hold less meaning for me if it were made known to me in words alone, and I had not the example of Christ, who has shown me the way by his deeds as well. I do your bidding in word and deed alike. I do it beneath the protection of your wings, for the peril would be too great if it were not that my soul has submitted to you and sought the shelter of your wings, and that my weakness is known to you. I am no more than a child, but my Father lives forever, and I have a protector great enough to save me. For he who begot me and he who watches over me are one and the same. And for me there is no good but you, the Almighty, who are with me even before I am with you. So to such as you command me to serve, I will reveal not what I have been, but what I have become and what I am. But since I do not scrutinize my own conduct, Let my words be understood as they are meant. 5. It is you, O Lord, who judge me. For though no one can know a man's thoughts except the man's own spirit that is within him, there are some things in man which even his own spirit within him does not know. But you, O Lord, know all there is to know of him, because you made him. Yet though in your sight I despise myself and consider myself as mere dust and ashes, there is one thing that I know about you that I do not know about myself. I know that it is impossible for you to suffer harm, whereas I do not know which temptations I can resist and which I cannot. This much I know, although at present I am looking at a confused reflection in a mirror, not yet face to face. And therefore, as long as I am away from you, during my pilgrimage, I am more aware of myself than of you. But my hope lies in the knowledge that you do not play us false. You will not allow us to be tempted beyond our powers. With the temptation itself, you will ordain the issue of it, and enable us to hold our own. I shall therefore confess both what I know of myself and what I do not know. For even what I know about myself, I only know because your light shines upon me. And what I do not know about myself, I shall continue not to know until I see you face to face, and my dusk is noonday. 6. My love of you, O Lord, is not some vague feeling. It is positive and certain. Your words struck into my heart, and from that moment I loved you. Besides this, all about me, heaven and earth, and all they contain proclaim that I should love you, and their message never ceases to sound in the ears of all mankind, so that there is no excuse for any not to love you. But more than all this, you will show pity on those whom you pity. You will show mercy where you are merciful. For if it were not for your mercy, heaven and earth would cry your praises to deaf ears. But what do I love when I love my God? Not material beauty or beauty of a temporal order. Not the brilliance of earthly light, so welcome to our eyes. Not the sweet melody of harmony and song. Not the fragrance of flowers, perfumes, and spices. Not manna or honey. Not limbs such as the body delights to embrace. It is not these that I love when I love my God. And yet when I love him, it is true that I love a light of a certain kind, a voice, a perfume, a food, an embrace. But they are of the kind that I love in my inner self. When my soul is bathed in light that is not bound by space, when it listens to sound that never dies away, when it breathes fragrance that is not borne away on the wind, when it tastes food that is never consumed by the eating, when it clings to an embrace from which it is not severed by fulfillment of desire, this is what I love when I love my God. But what is my God? I put my question to the earth. It answered, I am not God, and all things on earth declared the same. I asked the sea and the chasms of the deep and the living things that creep in them, but they answered, we are not your God. Seek what is above us. I spoke to the winds that blow, and the whole air, and all that lives in it, replied, Anaximenes is wrong, I am not God. I asked the sky, the sun, the moon, the stars, but they told me, neither are we the God whom you seek. I spoke to all the things that are about me, all that can be admitted by the door of the senses, and I said, since you are not my God, tell me about him, tell me something of my God. Clearly and loudly they answered, God is he who made us. I asked these questions simply by gazing at these things, and their beauty was all the answer they gave. And then I turned to myself and asked, who are you? A man, I replied, but it is clear that I have both body and soul, the one the outer, the other the inner part of me. Which of these two ought I have asked to help me find my God? With my bodily powers, I had already tried to find him in earth and sky. As far as the sight of my eyes could reach, like an envoy sent upon a search. But my inner self is the better of the two, for it was to the inner part of me that my bodily senses brought these messages. They delivered to their arbiter and judge the replies that they carried back from the sky and the earth and all they contain, those replies which stated, "We are not God, and God is he who made us." The inner part of man knows these things through the agency of the outer part. I, the inner man, know these things. I, the soul, know them through the senses of my body. I am not God. God is he who made me. Surely everyone whose senses are not impaired is aware of the universe around him. Why, then, does it not give the same message to us all? The animals, both great and small, are aware of it, but they cannot inquire into its meaning because they are not guided by reason, which can sift the evidence relayed to them by their senses. Man, on the other hand, can question nature. He is able to catch sight of God's invisible nature through his creatures. But his love of these material things is too great. He becomes their slave, and slaves cannot be judges. Nor will the world supply an answer to those who question it, unless they also have the faculty to judge it. It does not answer in different language. That is, it does not change its aspects, according to whether a man merely looks at it or subjects it to inquiry while he looks. If it did, its appearance would be different in each case. Its aspect is the same in both cases, but to the man who merely looks, it says nothing, while to the other it gives an answer. It would be nearer the truth to say that it gives an answer to all, but it is only understood by those who compare the message it gives them through their senses with the truth that is in themselves. For truth says to me, "Your God is not heaven or earth or any kind of bodily thing." We can tell this from the very nature of such things, for those who have eyes to see know that their bulk is less in part than the whole, and I know that my soul is the better part of me, because it animates the whole of my body. It gives life, and this is something that no body can give to another body. But God is even more. He is the life of my soul. 7. What then do I love when I love God? Who is this being who is so far above my soul? If I am to reach him, it must be through my soul. But it must go beyond the power by which I am joined to my body, and by which I fill its frame with life. This is not the power by which I find my God, for if it were, the horse and the mule, senseless creatures, could find him too, because they also have this same power that gives life to their bodies. But there's another faculty in me besides this. By it I not only give life to my body, but also give it the power of perceiving things by senses. God gave me this faculty when he ordered my eyes not to hear, but to see, and my ears not to see, but to hear. And to each of the other senses he assigned its own place and its own function. I, the soul, who am one alone, exercise all these different functions by means of my senses. But I must go beyond this faculty as well, for horses and mules also have it, since they too feel by means of their bodies. 8. So I must go beyond this natural faculty of mine as I rise by stages toward God. The next stage is memory, which is like a great field or a spacious palace, a storehouse for countless images of all kinds that are conveyed to it by the senses. In it are stored away all the thoughts by which we enlarge upon or diminish or modify in any way the perceptions at which we arrive through the senses. And it also contains anything else that has been entrusted to it for safekeeping, until such time as these things are swallowed up and buried in forgetfulness. When I use my memory to ask it to produce whatever it is that I wish to remember, some things it produces immediately, some are forthcoming only after a delay, as though they were being brought out from some inner hiding place. Others come spilling from the memory, thrusting themselves upon us when what we want is something quite different. As much as to say, perhaps we are what you want to remember. These I brush aside from the picture that memory presents to me, allowing my mind to pick what it chooses, until finally that which I wish to see stands out clearly and emerges into sight from its hiding place. Some memories present themselves easily and in the correct order just as I require them. They come and give place in their turn to others that follow upon them. And as their place is taken, they return to their place of storage, ready to emerge again when I want them. This is what happens when I recite something by heart. In the memory, everything is preserved separately, according to its category. Each is admitted through its own special entrance. For example, light, color, and shape are admitted through the eyes, sounds of all kinds through the ears, all sorts of smells through the nostrils, and every kind of taste through the mouth. The sense of touch, which is common to all parts of the body, enables us to distinguish between hard and soft, hot and cold, rough and smooth, heavy and light, and it can be applied to things that are inside the body as well as those to which are outside. All these sensations are retained in the great storehouse of the memory, which in some indescribable way secretes them in its folds. They can be brought out and called back again when they are needed, but each enters the memory through its own gateway and is retained in it. The things that we sense do not enter the memory themselves, but their images are there, ready to present themselves to our thoughts when we recall them. We may know by which of the senses these images were recorded and laid up in the memory, but who can tell how the images themselves are formed? Even when I am in darkness and in silence, I can, if I wish, picture colors in my memory. I can distinguish between black and white and any other color I wish, and while I reflect upon them, sounds do not break in and confuse the images of color which reached me through the eye. Yet my memory holds sounds as well, though it stores them separately. If I wish, I can summon them up too. They come forward at once so that I can sing as much as I want, even though my tongue does not move and my throat utters no sound. And when I recall into my mind this rich reserve of sound that entered my memory through my ears, the images of color that are also there in my memory do not interfere or intrude. In the same way, I can recall at will all the other things that my senses brought into my memory and deposited in it. I can distinguish the scent of lilies from that of violets, even though there is no scent at all in my nostrils. And simply by using my memory, I recognize that I like honey better than wine, and smooth things better than rough ones, although at that moment I neither taste nor touch anything. All this goes on inside me, in the vast cloisters of my memory. In it are the sky, the earth, and the sea, ready at my summons, together with everything that I have ever perceived in them by my senses, except the things which I have forgotten. In it I meet myself as well. I remember myself and what I have done, when and where I did it, and the state of my mind at the time. And my memory, too, are all the events that I remember, whether they are things that have happened to me or things I have heard from others. From the same source I can picture to myself all kinds of different images based upon either my own experience or upon what I find credible because it tallies with my own experience. I can fit them into the general picture of the past. From them I can make a surmise of actions and events and hopes for the future. I can contemplate them all over again as if they were actually present. If I say to myself in the vast cache of my mind where all those images of great things are stored, I shall do this or that, the picture of this or that particular thing comes into my mind at once. Or I may say to myself, if only this or that would happen, or God forbid that this or that should be. No sooner do I say this than the images of all things of which I speak spring forward from the same great treasure house of the memory. And in fact, I could not even mention them at all if the images were lacking. The power of the memory is prodigious, my God. It is a vast, immeasurable sanctuary. Who can plumb its depths? And yet it is a faculty of my soul. Although it is part of my nature, I cannot understand all that I am. This means, then, that the mind is too narrow to contain itself entirely. But where is that part of it that it does not itself contain? Is it somewhere outside of itself and not within it? How, then, can it be part of it if it is not contained in it? I am lost in wonder when I consider this problem. It bewilders me. Yet men go out and gaze in astonishment at high mountains, the huge waves of the sea, the broad reaches of rivers, the ocean that encircles the world, or the stars in their courses. But they pay no attention to themselves. They do not marvel at the thought that while I have been mentioning all these things, I have not been looking at them with my eyes, and that I could not even speak of mountains or waves, rivers or stars, which are things that I have seen, or of the ocean, which I know only on the evidence of others, unless I could see them in my mind's eye, in my memory, and with the same vast spaces between them that would be there if I were looking at them in the world outside myself. When I saw them with the sight of my eyes, I did not draw them bodily into myself. They are not inside me themselves, but only their images, and I know which of my senses imprinted each image on my mind. 9. These are not the only treasures stored in the vast capacity of my memory. It also contains all that I have ever learnt of the liberal sciences, except what I have forgotten. This knowledge it keeps apart from the rest, in an inner place, though it is wrong to speak of it as a place. And in their case it does not retain mere images, but the facts themselves. For any knowledge I may have of grammar, of the art of debating, or of the different categories of questions, remain in my memory, but not as though I merely retained an image of it, leaving the facts outside myself, or as though it sounded in my ear and then passed away. It is not like a voice that is imprinted on the mind through the ears, leaving a trace by which it can be recalled, as if its sounds were still to be heard even after it has become silent. Nor is it like an odor which, even though it does not last and is carried away on the wind, affects the sense of smell, and through it conveys to the memory an impression of itself, by which it can be remembered and reproduced. It is not like food that certainly loses its taste once it reaches the belly, and yet can be said to retain its taste in the memory. Again, it is unlike anything that the body feels by the sense of touch, and can be still sensed in the memory even after contact with it is lost. In these cases, the things themselves do not penetrate into the memory. It is simply that the memory captures their images with astonishing speed and stores them away in its wonderful system of compartments, ready to produce them again in just as wonderful a way when we remember them. 10. When I am told that it is possible to ask three kinds of questions, whether a thing is, what it is, and of what sort it is, I retain images of the sounds of which these words are composed. I know that these sounds have passed through the air, and now are no more. But the facts which they represent have not reached me through any of my bodily senses. I could not see them at all except in my mind, and it is not their images that I store in my memory, but the facts themselves. But they must themselves tell me, if they can, by what means they entered my mind. For I can run through all the organs of sense which are the body's gateways to the mind, but I cannot find any by which these facts could have entered. My eyes tell me, if they have color, we reported them. My ears say, if they have sound, it was we who gave notice to them. My nose says, if they have any smell, it was through me that they passed into the mind. The sense of taste says, if they have no taste, do not put your question to me. The sense of touch says, if it is not a body, I did not touch it, and if I did not touch it, I had no message to transmit. How then did these facts get into my memory? Where do they come from? I do not know. When I learned them, I did not believe them with another man's mind. It was my own mind that recognized them and admitted that they were true. I entrusted them to my own mind as though it were a place of storage from which I could produce them at will. Therefore, they must have been in my mind even before I learned them, though not present in my memory. Then whereabouts in my mind were they? How was it that I recognized them when they were mentioned and agreed that they were true? It must have been that they were already in my memory, hidden away in its deeper recesses, in so remote a part that I might not have been able to think of them at all if some other person had brought them to the fore by teaching me about them. 11. From this we can conclude that learning these facts, which do not reach our minds as images by means of the senses, but are recognized by us in our minds without images, as they actually are, is simply a process of thought by which we gather together things which, although they are muddled and confused, are already contained in the memory. When we give them our attention, we see to it that these facts, which have been lying scattered and unheeded, are placed ready at hand, so that they are easily forthcoming once we have grown used to them. My memory holds a great number of facts of this sort, things which I have already discovered, and, as I have said, placed ready to hand. This is what is meant by saying that we have learned them and know them. If for a short space of time I cease to give them my attention, they sink back and recede again into the more remote cells of my memory, so that I have to think them out again, like a fresh set of facts, if I am to know them. I have to shepherd them out again from their old lairs, because there is no other place where they could have gone. In other words, once they have been dispersed, I have to collect them again, and this is the derivation of the word cogitare, which means to think or to collect one's thoughts. For in Latin, the word cogo, meaning I assemble or I collect, is related to cogito, which means I think, in the same way as ago is related to agito, or facio, or factito. But the word cogito is restricted to the function of the mind. It is correctly used only of what is assembled in the mind, not what is assembled elsewhere. 12. The memory also contains the innumerable principles and laws of numbers and dimensions. None of these can have been conveyed to it by means of the bodily senses, because they cannot be seen, heard, smelled, tasted, or touched. I have heard the sounds of the words by which their meaning is expressed when they're discussed, but the words are one thing and the principles another. The words may sometimes be spoken in Latin and at other times in Greek, but the principles are neither Greek nor Latin. They are not language at all. I have seen lines drawn by architects, and they are sometimes as fine as the threads spun by spiders. But these principles are different. They are not images of things that the eye of my body has reported to me. We know them simply by recognizing them inside ourselves without reference to any material object. With all the senses of my body, I have become aware of numbers as they are used in counting things. But the principle of numbers by which we count is not the same. It is not an image of the things we count, but something that is there in its own right. If anyone is blind to it, he may laugh at my words. I shall pity him for his ridicule. 13. I carry all these facts in my memory, and I also remember how I learned them. I have also heard and remember many false arguments put forward to dispute them. Even if the arguments are false, the fact that I remember them is not false. I also remember distinguishing between the true facts and the false theories advanced against them. And there is a difference between seeing myself make this distinction now and remembering that I have made it often in the past, every time that I have given the matter any thought. So I not only remember that I have often understood these facts in the past, but I also commit to memory the fact that I understood them and distinguished the truth from the falsehood at the present moment. By this means I ensure that later on I shall remember that I understood them at the time, and I remember that I have remembered, just as later on, if I remember that I have been able to remember these facts now, it will be by the power of my memory that I shall remember doing so. 14. My memory also contains my feelings, not in the same way as they are present to the mind when it experiences them, but in quite a different way that is in keeping with the special power of memory. For even when I am unhappy, I can remember times when I was cheerful, and when I am cheerful, I can remember past unhappiness. I can recall past fears and yet not feel afraid. And when I remember that I once wanted something, I can do so without wishing to have it now. Sometimes memory induces the opposite feeling, for I can be glad to remember sorrow that is over and done with, and sorry to remember happiness that has come to an end. There would be nothing remarkable in this if memory recalled only our bodily sensations. For the mind is one thing, and the body another, and it would not be strange if I were glad to remember some bygone bodily pain. But the mind and the memory are one and the same. We even call the memory the mind, for when we tell another person to remember something, we say, "See that you bear this in mind." And when we forget something, we say, "It was not in my mind," or, it slipped my mind. This being so, how can it be that when I am glad to remember sorrow that is past, that is, when there is joy in my mind and sadness in my memory, how can it be that my mind is happy because of the joy that is in it, and yet my memory is not sad by reason of the sadness that is in it? No one could pretend that the memory does not belong to the mind. We might say that the memory is a sort of stomach for the mind, and that joy or sadness are like sweet or bitter food. When this food is committed to the memory, it is as though it had passed into the stomach where it can remain, but also loses its taste. Of course, it is absurd to suppose that the memory is like the stomach, but there is some similarity nonetheless. But when I say that the mind can experience four kinds of emotion, desire, fear, joy, and sorrow, I call them to mind from my memory, and if I enlarge upon this by analyzing and defining each of these emotions according to the different forms that each can take, I draw upon my memory and produce from it whatever I am going to say. Yet while I remember these feelings by drawing them from my memory, they do not produce any emotional effect in me. Before I recalled them and thought about them, they must have been present in my memory, because it was from there that I was able to summon them by the act of remembering. Perhaps these emotions are brought forward from the memory by the act of remembering, in the same way as cattle bring up food from the stomach when they chew the cud. But if this is so, when a man discusses them, that is, when he recalls them to mind, why does he not experience the pleasure of joy or the pain of sorrow in his mind, just as the animal tastes the food in its mouth? Perhaps the simile is unjustified, because the two processes are not alike at all. For if we had to experience sorrow or fear every time we mentioned these emotions, no one would be willing to speak of them. Yet we could not speak of them at all unless we could find in our memory not only the sounds of their names, which we retain as images imprinted on the memory by the senses of the body, but also the idea of the emotions themselves. But we did not admit these ideas through any of the body's gateways to the mind. They were either committed to the memory by the mind itself, as a result of its own experience of emotion, or else the memory retained them, even though they were not entrusted to it by the mind. 15. Whether this process takes place by means of images or not, it is not easy to say. I can mention a stone or the sun when these things are not actually present to my senses, but their images are present in my memory. I can speak of physical pain, but as long as I do not feel it, the pain itself is not present to me. Yet if an image of pain were not present in my memory, I should not know how to describe it, nor could I distinguish it from pleasure when I spoke of it. I can talk of physical health when I am in good health. The condition of which I speak is present to me. But unless an image of it were also present in my memory, I could not possibly remember what the sound of the word meant. Nor could sick people know what was meant when health was mentioned, unless an image of it were retained by the power of memory, even when health itself is absent from the body. I can speak of the numbers which we use in counting, but it is the numbers themselves, not their images, that are present in my memory. I speak of the sun's image, and this too is in my memory, but it is the image itself, not the image of an image, that I recall. It is the sun's image that presents itself to my mind when I perform the act of remembering. I can speak of memory, and I recognize what I speak of, but where else do I recognize it except in my memory itself? Can it be that the memory is not present to itself in its own right, but only by means of an image of itself? 16. I can mention forgetfulness and recognize what the word means, but how can I recognize the thing itself unless I remembered it? I am not speaking of the sound of the word, but of the thing which it signifies. If I had forgotten the thing itself, I should be utterly unable to recognize what the sound implied. When I remember memory, my memory is present to itself by its own power. But when I remember forgetfulness, two things are present: memory, by which I remember it, and forgetfulness, which is what I remember. Yet what is forgetfulness but the absence of memory? When it is present, I cannot remember. then how can it be present in such a way that I can remember it? If it is true that what we remember we retain in our memory, and if it is also true that unless we remember forgetfulness, we could not possibly recognize the meaning of the word when we heard it, then it is true that forgetfulness is retained in the memory. It follows that the very thing which by its presence causes us to forget must be present if we are to remember it. Are we to understand from this that when we remember it, it is not itself present in the memory, but only there by means of its image? For if forgetfulness were itself present, would not its effect be to make us forget and not to remember? Who is to carry the research beyond this point? Who can understand the truth of the matter? Oh Lord, I am working hard in this field, and the field of my labors is my own self. I have become a problem to myself, like land which a farmer works only with difficulty and at the cost of much sweat. For I am not now investigating the tracks of the heavens, or measuring the distance of the stars, or trying to discover how the earth hangs in space. I am investigating myself, my memory, my mind. There is nothing strange in the fact that whatever is not myself is far from me, but what could be nearer to me than myself? Yet I do not understand the power of memory that is in myself, although without it I could not even speak of myself. What am I to say when I am quite certain that I can remember forgetfulness? Am I to say that what I remember is not in my memory? Or am I to say that the reason why forgetfulness is in my memory is to prevent me from forgetting? Both suggestions are utterly absurd. There is the third possibility, that I should say that when I remember forgetfulness, it is its image that is retained in my memory and not the thing itself. But how can I say this when, if the image of anything is imprinted in my memory, the thing itself must first be present in order that my memory may receive the impression of its image? It is by this means that I remember Carthage and all the other places where I have been. By the same method, I remember the faces of people whom I have seen, and everything that the other senses have reported to me. By it I remember the health and sickness of my own body. My memory captured images of these things when they were present, and the images remained so that I could see them and think about them by remembering them even when the things themselves were absent. Therefore, if forgetfulness is retained in the memory, not by itself, but by means of its image, it must have been present at some time in order that the memory could capture its image. But when it was present, how did it inscribe its image on my memory when its mere presence is enough to delete what is already noted there? Yet, however it may be, and in whatever inexplicable and incomprehensible way it happens, I am certain that I remember forgetfulness, even though forgetfulness obliterates all that we remember. 17. The power of memory is great, O Lord. It is awe-inspiring in its profound and incalculable complexity. Yet it is my mind. It is myself. What then am I, my God? What is my nature? A life that is ever varying, full of change and of immense power. The wide plains of my memory and its innumerable caverns and hollows are full beyond compute of countless things of all kinds. Material things are there by means of their images. Knowledge is there of itself. Emotions are there in the form of ideas or impressions of some kind, for the memory retains them even while the mind does not experience them, although whatever it is in the memory must also be in the mind. My mind has the freedom of them all. I can glide from one to the other. I can probe deeply into them and never find the end of them. This is the power of memory. This is the great force of life living in man, mortal though he is. My God, my true life, what then am I to do? I shall go beyond this force that is in me, this force that we call memory, so that I may come to you, my sweetness and light. What have you to say to me? You are always there above me. And as I rise up toward you in my mind, I shall go beyond even this force that is in me, this force that we call memory, longing to reach out to you by the only possible means, and to cling to you in the only way in which it is possible to cling to you. For beasts and birds also have memory, otherwise they can never find their lairs or nests or the many other things that are part of their habitual life. In fact, they could have no habits at all if it were not for their memory. So I must go beyond memory too, if I am to reach the God who made me different from the beasts that walk on the earth, and wiser than the birds that fly in the air. I must pass beyond memory to find you, my true God, my sure sweetness. But where will the search lead me? Where am I to find you? If I find you beyond my memory, it means that I have no memory of you. How then am I to find you, if I have no memory of you? 18. The woman who had lost a coin searched for it by the light of a lantern, but she would never have found it unless she had remembered it. Otherwise, when it was found, how would she have known whether it was the one she was looking for? I remember that I have often lost things and found them again after a search, and I know this is because when I was looking for them, people would ask me, "Is this it?" or "Is that it?" And I always answered, "No," unless they showed me the thing I wanted. Whatever it was, unless I had remembered it, I should never have found it, even when it was shown to me, because I should not have recognized it. It is always the same when we look for something that we have lost, and then find it. If a thing vanishes from sight, but not from the memory, and this happens with any visible object, its image is retained within us, and we look for it until it comes to light again. Once it has been found, it is recognized by means of the image within us. We do not say that we have found what we have lost unless we recognize it, and we cannot recognize it unless we remember it. It is only lost to sight, not to memory. 19. When, therefore, the memory loses something, and this is what happens when we forget something and try to remember it, where are we to look for it except in the memory itself? And if the memory offers us something else instead, as may happen, we reject what it offers until the one thing that we want is presented. When it is presented to us, we say, "This is it." But we could not say this unless we recognized it, and we could not recognize it unless we remembered it, or it could be that it had not entirely escaped our memory, but part of it remained, giving a clue to the remainder, because the memory, realizing that something was missing and feeling crippled by the loss of something to which it had grown accustomed, kept demanding that the missing part should be restored. Something of this sort happens when we see or think of a person whom we know, but cannot remember his name and try to recall it. If any other name but his occurs to us, we do not apply it to him, because we do not normally associate that name with him. So we reject all names until we think of the one that corresponds accurately with our normal mental picture of the man. But how can we think of his name unless we bring it out from the memory? For even if we recognize it because someone else prompts us, it is still by our own memory that we do so, because we do not accept it as a fresh piece of knowledge, but agree that it is the right name, since we can now remember it. If the name were completely obliterated from our minds, we could not remember it even if we were prompted, for we do not entirely forget what we remember that we have forgotten. If we had completely forgotten it, we should not even be able to look for what we have lost. 20. How then do I look for you, O Lord? For when I look for you, who are my God, I am looking for a life of blessed happiness. I shall look for you so that my soul may live, for it is my soul that gives life to my body, and it is you who give life to my soul. How then am I to search for this blessed life? For I do not possess it until I can rightly say, "This is all that I want. Happiness is here." Am I to seek it in my memory, as though I had forgotten it, but still remembered that I had forgotten it? Or am I to seek it through the desire to get to know it as if it were something unknown to me, either because I have never known it or because I have forgotten it so completely that I do not even remember having forgotten it? Surely happiness is what everyone wants, so much so that there can be none who do not want it. But if they desire it so much, where did they learn what it was? If they have learned to love it, where do they see it? Certainly happiness is in us, though how it comes to be there, I cannot tell. Some people are happy in the sense that they have actually achieved a state of happiness. Others are happy only in the hope of achieving it. They possess happiness in a lesser degree than those who have achieved it. But even so, they are better off than those who are happy neither in the achievement of this blessed state, nor in the expectation of it. Yet even these others must possess happiness in a certain sense. Otherwise, they would not long for it as they do. And there can be no doubt that they do long for it. By some means or other, they have learned what it is. In some sense, they have knowledge of it. And the problem before me is to discover whether or not this knowledge is in the memory. If it is, it means that at some point in the past we have been happy. It may be that we were all once happy individually, or it may be that we were all happy in Adam, the first sinner in whom we all died and from whom we are all descended in a heritage of misery. But this is not the question that is now before me. The problem is whether happiness is in the memory. For we should not love happiness unless we knew what it was. We have heard it named, and we all admit that it is our ambition to achieve it, for we do not take pleasure simply in the sound of the word. When a Greek hears it named in Latin, he derives no pleasure from it because he does not know what has been said. But we get pleasure from it, just as he would if he had heard it spoken in Greek. This is because happiness is neither Greek nor Latin. But we are all eager to achieve it, whether we speak Greek or Latin or any other language. It must then be known to all. And there could be no doubt that if it were possible to put the question in a common language and ask all men whether they wish to be happy, all would reply that they did. But this could only happen if happiness itself, that is, the state that the word signifies, were to be found somewhere in their memories. But is it to be found in the memory in the same way as Carthage that I have seen is present in my memory? This cannot be the case, because happiness cannot be seen by the eye, since it is not a material object. Is it in the memory in the same way as we remember numbers? Again, this cannot be the case, because once we have the knowledge of numbers, we cease trying to acquire it. But even though we have knowledge of happiness, and love it for that reason, we continue to wish to achieve it, so that we may be happy. Is it then in the memory in the same way as the art of public speaking is there? Again, the answer is no. People recognize what is meant by the word eloquence, even though they have not mastered the art themselves, and many of them would like to be eloquent. This shows that they have knowledge of what it is, but by means of their bodily senses, they have been made aware of eloquence in others. It has given them pleasure, and they desire the gift for themselves. Of course, they would get no pleasure from it unless they had some deeper knowledge of it, and they would not wish to have it for themselves unless they enjoyed it. But in the case of happiness, there is no bodily sense by which we can experience it in others. Perhaps it is in the memory in the same way as we remember joy. Even when I am sad, I can remember joy, just as I can visualize happiness when I am unhappy. Yet I have never been aware of joy through any of the bodily senses. I have not heard it or seen it, smelled it or tasted it or touched it. It is something I have experienced in my mind on occasions of joy, and the knowledge of it has remained firmly in my memory, so that I can always recall it, sometimes with disgust and sometimes with longing, according to the differences between the things that I remember having enjoyed. For I have at times taken great joy in shameful things, and when I remember them now, I loathe and detest them. At other times I have enjoyed good and honorable things, and I remember them with longing, although they may now be beyond my reach, so that the remembrance of past joy makes me sad. When and where, therefore, did I experience a state of blessed happiness, so that I am enabled to remember it and love it and long for it? I am not alone in this desire, nor are there only a few who share it with me. Without exception, we all long for happiness. Unless we had some sure knowledge of it, we should not desire it with such certainty. But if two men were asked whether they wanted to serve in the army, one might reply that he did, and the other that he did not. If, on the other hand, they were asked whether they wanted to be happy, they would both reply at once, and without hesitation, that they did. The only reason why one of them should wish to serve in the army and the other not to serve would be that they wanted to be happy. Is it that different persons find joy in different things? All agree that they want to be happy, just as, if they were asked, they would all agree that they desire joy. In fact, they think that joy is the same as happiness. They may all search for it in different ways, but try their hardest to reach the same goal, that is, joy. No one can say that he has no experience of joy, and this is why he finds it in his memory and recognizes it when he hears the phrase, a state of happiness. 22. O Lord, far be it from the heart of your servant who confesses to you, far be it from me to think that whatever joy I feel makes me truly happy, for there is a joy that is not given to those who do not love you, but only to those who love you for your own sake. You yourself are their joy. Happiness is to rejoice in you, and for you, and because of you. This is true happiness, and there is no other. Those who think that there is another kind of happiness look for joy elsewhere, but theirs is not true joy. Their minds are set upon something akin to joy. 23. We cannot therefore be certain that all men desire true happiness, because there are some who do not look for joy in you, since to rejoice in you is the only true happiness. We must conclude that they do not desire true happiness. It may be that all men do desire to be happy, but because the impulses of nature and the spirit are at war with one another, they cannot do all that their will approves. They fall back upon what they are able to do and find contentment in this way. For their will to do what they cannot do is not strong enough to enable them to do it. If I ask them whether they prefer truth or falsehood as the foundation of their joy, they all reply that they would choose truth, and they say this as unhesitatingly as they say they wish to be happy. True happiness is to rejoice in the truth, for to rejoice in the truth is to rejoice in you, O God, who are the truth. You, my God, my true light, to whom I look for salvation. This is the happiness that all desire. All desire this, the only true state of happiness. All desire to rejoice in truth. I have known many men who wish to deceive, but none who wish to be deceived. Where did they learn the meaning of happiness unless it was where they learned the meaning of truth? For they love truth, since they do not like to be deceived. And when they love happiness, which is the same as to rejoice in truth, they must love truth also. But they could not love it unless they had some knowledge of it in their memory. Why then do they not take joy in it? Why are they not happy? It is because they attend far more closely to other things, whose power to make them unhappy is greater than the power of their dim memory of truth to make them happy. There is still a faint glow of light in man. Let him walk on, for fear that darkness may engulf him. But why does the truth engender hatred? Why does your servant meet with hostility when he preaches the truth, although men love happiness, which is simply the enjoyment of truth? It can only be that man's love of truth is such that when he loves something that is not the truth, he pretends to himself that what he loves is the truth, and because he hates to be proved wrong, he will not allow himself to be convinced that he is deceiving himself. So he hates the real truth for the sake of what he takes to his heart in its place. Men love the truth when it bathes them in its light. They hate it when it proves them wrong, because they hate to be deceived themselves, but are glad if they can deceive others. They love the truth when it is revealed to them, but hate it when it reveals that they are wrong. They reap their just rewards. For those who do not wish to stand condemned by the truth find themselves unmasked against their will, and also find the truth is denied to them. This is precisely the behavior of the human mind. In its blind inertia, in its abject shame, it loves to lie concealed, yet it wishes that nothing should be concealed from it. Its reward is just the opposite of desire, for it cannot conceal itself from the truth. But truth remains hidden from it. Yet even in this wretched state, it would still rather find joy in truth than in falsehood. One day, then, it shall be happy if it learns to ignore all that distracts it and to rejoice in truth, the sole truth by which all else is true. 24. See how I have explored the vast field of my memory in search of you, O Lord. I have not found you outside it, for I have discovered nothing about you except what I have remembered since the time when I first learned about you. Ever since then I have not forgotten you, for I found my God who is truth itself, where I found truth, and ever since I learned the truth I have not forgotten it. So since the time when I first learned of you, you have always been present in my memory, and it is there that I find you whenever I am reminded of you and find delight in you. This is my holy joy, which in your mercy you have given me, heedful of my poverty. 25. But in which part of my memory are you present, O Lord? What cell have you constructed for yourself in my memory? What sanctuary have you built there for yourself? That you should be present in it is a great honor, but I must now ask myself in what part of it you are present. When I remind myself of you, I go beyond those functions of the memory that I share with the beasts, for I did not find you amongst the images of material things. I went on to search for you in the part of my memory where the emotions of my mind are stored, but here too I did not find you. I passed on to the seat of the mind itself, for this too is in the memory, since the mind can remember itself. But you were not there either. For you are not the image of a material body, nor are you an emotion such as is felt by living men when they are glad or sorry, when they have sensations of desire or fear, when they remember or forget, or when they experience any other feelings. In the same way, you are not the mind itself, for you are the Lord God of the mind. All these things are subject to change, but you remain supreme over all things, immutable, and yet you have deigned to be present in my memory ever since I first learned of you. Why do I ask what place is set aside in my memory as your dwelling, as if there were distinctions of place in the memory? Truly you dwell in it, because I remember you ever since I first came to learn of you, and it is there that I find you when I am reminded of you. 26. Where then did I find you so that I could learn of you? For you were not in my memory before I learned of you. Where else then did I find you to learn of you, unless it was in yourself, above me? Whether we approach you or depart from you, you are not confined to any place. You are truth, and you are everywhere present, where all seek counsel of you. You reply to all at once, though the counsel each seeks is different. The answer you give is clear, but not all hear it clearly. All ask you whether they wish to ask. All ask you whatever they wish to ask, but the answer they receive is not always what they want to hear. The man who serves you best is the one who is less intent on hearing from you what he wills to hear than on shaping his own will according to what he hears from you. 27. I have learnt to love you late. Beauty at once so ancient and so new. I have learned to love you late. You were within me, and I was in the world outside myself. I searched for you outside myself, and disfigured as I was, I fell upon the lovely things of your creation. You were with me, but I was not with you. The beautiful things of this world kept me far from you, and yet, if they had not been in you, they would have had no being at all. You called me, you cried aloud to me, you broke my barrier of deafness, you shone upon me, your radiance enveloped me, you put my blindness to flight, you shed your fragrance about me. I drew breath, and now I gasp for your sweet odor. I tasted you, and now I hunger and thirst for you. You touched me, and I am inflamed with the love of your peace.